Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Duane Freitas.
And I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
This week, the NSA tracks your cell phones and knows where you are. Cyber Monday's picking up, and the future of commerce is in drones and robots, and it's not that far off. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I have been looking into recently, you know, I've got a fairly sort of growing Blu-ray collection. I've got like maybe five file boxes now worth of Blu-rays.
That's not a fairly growing one. That is a substantial collection of Blu-ray discs.
Substantial.
Five banker boxes?
Pretty much banker boxes, yeah. There's special cloth cases that are made for storage, general storage, but I put my Blu-rays in there. And, you know, up until this point, like, a lot of the Blu-rays that I buy have also the digital download as an option, as a free offer, along with the physical Blu-ray disc itself. And, I used to do the iTunes download, but the problem with the iTunes thing, up until recently, up until the last year, the way that the iTunes digital download worked is that you had to put the physical digital download disc into a drive and then enter in a code, and then it would start downloading the media off of the drive and onto your iTunes.
Wait, you put
iTunes
the Blu-ray
account.
Disc into your
not,
Mac?
Not a Blu-ray disc. It's a it's the separate disc that comes with the – it'll
oh,
be
right. like the Sony Yeah, digital.
It's not a DVD either. It's the
it's some proprietary disc type format that
right.
basically gives you a hardware code that would tell iTunes to go out and get this digital movie for you.
Yeah, pretty much. Or sometimes the coded encoded movie will be on that disc itself, and it'll transfer it onto your
that
system.
That is a lot of plastic to waste.
It,
when you
it
can
really
just give you
is.
A code.
It really is. And on top of that, I mean, who has a disk drive these days in their system? Like, I run off of a Mac Air, and I don't have access to a disk drive on without getting a
That's
separate one.
That's probably why they changed it, because they stopped. I mean, they don't have any computers that have disk drives now that the Mac Pro is gone.
Right. So, so Mac has changed their policy there. But a lot of the disks that I have, the Blu-ray disks that I have, also have this format called Ultraviolet. And I didn't think anything of it, because I know Ultraviolet was developed by a consortium of media distribution companies. Yeah, content producers. I think Warner Brothers, Universal, they're all involved in this Ultraviolet.
It's kind of like the Hulu for movies.
Right, right. Because it was developed by them, it's highly DRM'd. And everything. It's not very easy to use outside of the ecosphere that they've built up for it. So I didn't really
Although
think...
it does support a ton of things.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that is one of the things that I discovered this weekend. So I'm like, I'm going through my discs and I'm like, you know what? I have this free material on here. There's a limited time offer that I can take advantage of it. You know, the codes are only good for a certain period of time before they expire. I might as well take advantage of it. So I signed up with Ultraviolet, and Ultraviolet is associated with a streaming service called Vudu. And Vudu is available everywhere. Like, the Vudu is on my PlayStation 3, It's on the iOS. So I can watch it on my iPad and my iPhone. It's on the Roku. It's pretty widely distributed. It's on the web. So I was able to take advantage of about 18 different movies that I had in my Blu-ray collection that had ultraviolet codes that I hadn't previously used. And that Vudu service looks great. It streams at 1080p and 5.1 channel stereo. Looks great, sounds great. It's a really good looking service. So I've completely turned around from dismissing it and just thinking of it as some useless extra on the Blu-ray disc to taking advantage of it and enjoying that service. I even downloaded a couple of over the Black Friday weekend. They had some deals on some Blu-ray. On some HDX movies on Vudu. I got a couple of the. I got the two Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies.
Oh, really?
For like $5 each.
Okay.
So, not bad. Guy Ritchie.
Yeah. I just, the whole registration kills me.
Well, here's the thing. I would say that the good news about Ultraviolet and Vudu is that they are cross-platform, so mm-hmm. you can watch movies and lots of stuff. It's one of the things that I've been running into, and I mean, we talked about this earlier this year. I've been kind of like, hey, do I buy myself on Amazon or do I buy it on Apple? And I've been buying my digital videos on Amazon because I know it's cross-platform. I haven't seen the kind of widespread breadth that Amazon has on Hulu or on Vudu or Ultraviolet.
Yeah.
So I've been hesitant to jump into that. Apple has a good advantage because, like, you know, they went from 720p to 1080p for anything you ever bought that was in HD without charging anybody any extra. So that's kind of cool. If they do that for 4K, they'll be like the bee's knees. But there's just a lot of options out there, and I'm glad you're taking advantage of the digital revolution, Andy, from the guy who basically has who's tried to digitize all of his media. I'm glad you're taking advantage. Hopefully you don't have a CD collection lying around.
I still do. In fact, and we'll get into that a little bit later, but one of the things I took advantage of over the Black Friday shopping holiday, as it were, is they had some 3 terabyte drives for $99. So I bought a couple of them. And,
wow, which kind? Reds or greens or blues or blacks?
It doesn't matter because they're not going to be drives that I have in constant service. They're going to be ones that I archive stuff onto. Like, for example, one of them I'm planning on ripping lossless copies of all my CDs, existing physical CDs, and then getting rid of the physical CDs.
Don't get rid of the physical CDs. Those are your license to have that music in the first place.
No, I guess there you go.
You have to store them somewhere. You can't throw them away.
Well, that's excellent advice. Another thing that I've been playing with is a video game called The Stanley Parable. First of all, let me preface this by saying that over the Black Friday post Thanksgiving weekend, Steam had their autumn sale, and anytime Steam has a sale, it's bittersweet because the discounts are so deep that you want to buy just everything.
So you end up spending so much cash.
Yeah. But the Stanley Parable, I found it was one purchase that I found was really worth it, and I think I've talked about the Stanley Parable on this show before, but when I talked about it before, it was a mod for Portal 2. And mm-hmm. since then, those developers have spun it off into its own standalone game, completely redid the graphics, added some new story elements to it, and it's really a fascinating game. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. It's essentially it's an existential exploration into choice and human free will, but it also makes this meta commentary on the nature of video game narratives themselves. It's one of my favorite sort of small independent games that I've played in the last couple of years. I would nominate this game for Game of the Year, to be honest. I mean, it's not graphically, it's not in the realm of a GTA 5 or Last of Us, but just what it what it sort of forces you to think about in the course of playing this game. It really gets you thinking about the nature of free will and how you play video games. So anyone who's like any sort of fan of first-person video games or video games in general, I highly recommend this game. It's on Steam now. It's no longer discounted, but it's not that expensive anyway. It's like $13.
Yeah, no, I've heard great things about the game, and one of the ones that I've eventually mean to pick up, but I got to go one game at a time. Just finished Tomb Raider, and now starting Last of Us.
Yeah, I picked up Tomb Raider 2 over the on Steam because it was cheap.
Yeah, it's $10.
Wow, I just picked up a book.
Reading, who does that anymore?
But you had an amazing adventure yourself, Dwayne, over the last week.
Oh yeah, I got to hang out in the TARDIS and meet the 11th Doctor, Matt Smith, the 11th Doctor who's possibly the 12th Doctor. basically, I went to the United Kingdom. Doctor Who had its first big convention, the 50th anniversary, and my girlfriend and I, both of us are big Doctor Who fans. And we checked it out. We got the special TARDIS level gold pass, whatever.
Wow.
And we had access to the lounge. We had access to the floor. We hooked it up with we got a picture inside one of the older sets of the TARDIS. Mm-hmm. I think it's the set right before Amy and Rory, right before he meets the girl who waited.
Yeah.
And the one that David Tennant left, really. And we got to take a couple pictures with Matt Smith. One really goofy, one normal.
Did you get to talk to him for a little bit, or
got to say hi? I didn't get to talk. There was a long line behind us. But it was cool. I mean, the guy is really young. His mom's really proud of him. She was there when he was taking all these
Matt
pictures.
Matt Smith's mom?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's like, "Hey, everyone, this is my mom."
That's adorable.
Yeah, Jenna Coleman was there. Sat in a couple panels, not on the panel, just witnessed a couple panels. My favorite of which was the Stephen Moffat panel with Matt Smith, Jenna, and one of his producers, and Jenna Coleman. That is, and. Got some great insights into what's happening next. Also sat in on a great panel with some of the living previous doctors, the actors who played them. And overall, it was a fantastic experience. The convention center that London uses makes every other convention center I've seen look like a pea.
Wow.
It is humongous. They built it in the edge of town. The subway takes you right there, I guess the tube, the underground. And they're putting together a Comic-Con London, and I think it's going to do really well if they use the Excel Center for it.
Oh, wow. That sounds like it would be a great idea.
They also have their Eurogamer conference there.
Mm-hmm.
That's starting up, and I think that's going to be big. It's basically they're inviting the entire continent to a convention in London.
Speaking of the Doctor Who thing, did you see... An Adventure in Space and Time, the TV movie that was the making of the origin story of Doctor Who?
I didn't see that. I did see a lot of William Hartnell footage.
Uh-huh.
He's the first Doctor from back in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
November 23rd, 1963. He's the first guy to show up as a Doctor. And
you know, there was a lot of talk about him and how he kind of set the stage. And I went on Netflix and I found a special called the, not a special, but a four-part series called The Aztecs. Back in the day, before the 2005 revival, Doctor Who was only a half an hour long TV show. So this was like 2 hours of this thing called The Aztecs. It is remarkably different, but it is remarkably similar. But yeah, it was a wonderful experience. Fans everywhere, people dressed up like everything. I happen to have a coat that is modeled off of the 10th Doctor, David Tennant's coat.
Like brown with
playing that character. The long brown kind
with
of...
With light blue pinstripes?
I don't have the suit. I just have his overcoat, the brown overcoat. But there are lots of people in that coat and other stuff. And yeah, I mean, it was, we just got immersed. And for a guy who's a geek, but also spends his, you know, I'm a closet geek is what I am. I spend my days in a professional atmosphere, and then I go home and I'm sitting with my girlfriend and we're watching, like, you know, we're going over our favorite list of Star Trek Next Generation episodes. And, you know, we're just kind of exploring that. So when I was there, I felt at once at home. And I felt at once like I'm surrounded by people who are even more steeped in the situation than I am. But the cool thing is, we had friends who were like, "What are you doing, Doctor? What? What are you talking about? Not Doctor. What Doctor Who?" And we'd be like, "This is crazy." Okay, so we went out there, and you know, the show aired. We DVR'd it because we were out with some friends in London. We went and watched it the next morning. We woke up and we found out that it was the largest telecast ever. When I tweeted that, friends were suddenly like, "So I got to look into this Doctor Who thing." Google had doodles for 3 days in a row.
Yeah.
Different doodles for the UK website, different doodles for the US website, and other things like that. So, I mean, the pervasiveness was tight. And then as a geek, you know, I mean, we did that for 2 days, but then, you know, we were there for about, you know, 13 nights, 2 weeks. And if you're into anything that regards fantasy, then you need to check out Edinburgh. And you need to check out some of the sites in London, specifically the Tower of London. The Tower of London is the Age of Empires 2 perfect castle. perfect structure. Like, you've got inner walls, you've got outer walls, this, you've got that. It's not actually a tower. It's not actually a tower.
It's like a big block.
It's a fortress.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a proper fortress built over 1,000 years.
Sure. Did you see Henry VIII's mail chain mail, his armored suit?
Yeah, I saw
with
that.
With the big ass cod piece.
Yeah, yeah. There's a large cod piece there. But you know, a lot of that stuff, the armories put all that stuff up, and a lot of that stuff is kind of fake because it came out before that the technology to build that kind of armor. Showed up. So, like, when you watch Game of Thrones and it's supposed to be medieval, but at the same time they're wearing these big armor pieces, those pieces come from the Renaissance, so there's kind of a there's a folkloric piece to it. But yeah, Henry VIII and his big cod piece and his six wives, and you know, three of them got cut, their heads cut off there and everything. Also, you know, we went to Edinburgh, saw the castle, Edinburgh Castle. This is that mystic castle on a hill. It's literally on what they call the mound. It grows out of rock as if a wizard put it together. It is absolutely phenomenal. So we just saw this stuff like that. So that's where I spent my last couple of weeks, just geeking out with some British history, tasting some scotch, hanging out with Matt Smith. I'm looking at kind of the best vacation ever. Also, you know, it's England and Scotland, so my favorite accent in English, aside from the West Indian accent, is a Scottish accent. So I had a lot of fun just hearing people talk, getting people to say things to me, you know, not like say, "Hey, can you say this, but like, you know, using conversations to get to certain places. It's nice because, you know, last year I went over to India and it was great, but it was a little stressful. So the Red Fort, which is clearly inspiration for the Red Keep. If you go to Edinburgh, for anyone who's a Harry Potter fan, the old city in Edinburgh is very Hogsmeade and all those things.
Well, I'm looking at pictures of Edinburgh Castle, and it looks just like Hogwarts.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling came up for the ideas behind Harry Potter when living in Edinburgh. So you get a lot of that from that storyline. And while she's very sort of like meta geek. She takes a lot of old folkloric things and everything, and she kind of puts she puts a new spin on them. You know, there's something, even though it's like kind of out of our generation, there's something great there because it does make you relive sort of like the stories behind the Sphinx and a couple other things like that, and she kind of gives them a new meaning. But yeah, when you're in Edinburgh, you feel like you're in that space, that kind of Harry Potter space. So in addition to that, you feel like you can be like, I don't know, if you look at Edinburgh Castle, you could see a dragon attacking that castle, no problem.
Oh, totally.
But yeah, it was a fantastic John out there, and the Doctor Who stuff was pretty tight.
Nice.
Can't get enough. I just can't wait until, you know, the Christmas special comes out and we get to meet the new Doctor.
Because I haven't seen the don't say anything, because I haven't seen the 50th anniversary, the Day of the Doctor.
I didn't drop any spoilers. I guarantee.
Okay. I'm waiting for. I'm getting the Blu-ray, the 3D Blu-ray, and I'm going to watch it for the first time there.
There you go.
Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with? You've been doing something really interesting too.
Well, I've been sort of working on a project that I've kind of always thought about for many years, but never jumped on the bullet, and that is building an R2 unit, specifically an R2-D2.
That's awesome.
So I am, and this is going to be a life-size R2-D2, which has the ability to not only move around, but has the same sort of mannerisms in terms of sound and lights, and I think it's going to be pretty epic, but I think this is going to be one of those builds that could take me a year or more. So we'll see how that turns out. But go ahead.
No, I mean, so you're saying it's got all the lights? You're going to get a like radio control, like an RC car kind of stuff?
Yeah, no, I think that's the current plan. Now, of course, things could deviate, but get a radio control and then do a bit of soldering, or potentially maybe with Arduinos and XBs and that sort of electronics to do the communication.
And is it going to be an original trilogy R2 or a Neo trilogy R2?
This is going to be an original trilogy R2 for whatever that means.
In the Neo trilogy, R2 can fly. So I just want to make sure that you're not making a flying.
No, R2. This is not going to have the thrusters. Well, the jetpack on the back.
Will it have the oil spout? The oil takes out a droid.
You know, I think I'm gonna pass on that for at least this first iteration. The really cool thing about it is like there's a whole community behind it. So there's this thing called the R2 Builders Club, because people build more than just R2-D2, although R2-D2 tends to be the most popular one. And in that club, there's all these little subsets and pockets. There's like a UK community, there's a Bay Area community. A lot of people who you can find out what they've done. They've made plans and blueprints of down to like the last minuscule part of what is to spec, and built it out of so many different materials. There's just a lot of information and a wealth of knowledge there. It's really cool.
Is this where the guys who make the iRobot guys made Roomba from? Because my Roomba is just like one of those things in a Death Star. It runs around, it makes all this noise, it does all this beeping.
You know,
those floors in the Death Star, the floors were very clean. They're very clean.
It wouldn't surprise me. Actually, what's really fabulous is a lot of the times when you go to various conventions or out and you see R2 units out there, often it's organizations who are emailed this community and said, hey, can you guys bring a few droids for this and that? There's actually a news story, and I think we may have quickly touched upon it, or maybe have touched about it prior to a show, of how a couple people from actually this club in UK are hired to work on the brand new R2 units for Star Wars for the new movies. So
it's pretty amazing.
That's great. I mean, it's awesome to see that the fandom of Star Wars has spawned several real cults. It's almost like Catholicism, and how you have different orders, like the Jesuit order or the Franciscan order or whatever. Like, you've got the Lando Calrissian order, the Lando Society.
Woo!
Exactly. You've got the R2 Builders Club.
These are all little kind of facets that tie into a larger story, just like how all these different types of Christians tied into the larger story of the Bible. That's great. So you're making this R2-D2 unit. Are you going to have a 3D recording projector that is stuck on, help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope?
You know what is actually really what I find super amazing is, so when in the movies, they used all sorts of R2-D2s. You know, some were controllable. A lot of them did have, you know, a person inside of them.
Like a little Ewok actor inside them.
Yep.
You're not tall, but are you short enough to be inside of an R2?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But, like, a lot of these didn't actually work or were done, you know, later with, animation and other things. And people have been making specs, you know, getting things to actually pop up, tossing lightsabers, making a projector like that, which actually works and also does a little bit of like fog machine esque to give it a bit of that. That
R2 was the ultimate Swiss Army knife.
He really was. And the best friend you could have.
He was the ultimate plot device saver.
It's like the phrase Deus Ex Machina, you know.
Uh-huh.
Right? It really means like the machine from God, right? He was the machine.
Right.
It's like if I ever wanted a friend, you know, I don't have enough time to stay around to have a pet at in my apartment. I'm always at work. Well, now I have a friend in R2-D2 who can come around with me and we can go for walks. You know?
Well, not if he doesn't have the boosters. You can't do any stairs. So it's going to have to be only handicap accessible places. He might be able to do stairs up, but going down is always hard for him. You know, with the little... Yeah, yeah. So, voice activation.
I'm not so sure. That's a debate. That's a debate that he had. Maybe for V1, not so much.
V1? Well, maybe if Google gets their hands on your device, they can totally add Android voice activation.
That is a smooth segue into our headlines, because as you may have read, over the last half year, Google has been quietly acquiring 7 technology companies in an effort to create a new generation of robots.
Robots. Guys, that's this episode. We are in the robot drill down episode. Let's call it...
Robots and drones.
The drill drone.
Drill drone.
The bot zone.
Bot zone.
And who's going to be heading up that Google's robot division is none other than Andy Rubin, the guy who built Google's Android software into...
It's no coincidence that he built software called Android, and now he's working on robots.
Yep.
Let's get some words, some vocabulary out here. So, robot, right?
Yeah.
Robot. What does robot mean to you guys?
Robot to me, breaking it down, it's really a manual labor saving device that replaces something that human would normally do.
Okay, I feel like it's a virtual person, you know, it's run by some sort of computer program or circuitry or AI, that kind of thing, right?
That's more specifically like an Android.
No. Yeah. An Android is a robot in the shape or likeness of a person.
Mm-hmm.
That's what an Android is. Now, droid, the word that we use in Star Wars and that is used on some of the Verizon Android products, was actually created by George Lucas and his team when they were putting together Star Wars. Because they had these things they wanted people to recognize what the word was, but clearly they're not shaped like people with the exception of C-3PO. But an Android is like a synthetic person. Data is an Android. Awesome dude from Alien and Alien 2. Aliens, sorry.
Ash.
They're androids, right?
Ghost in the Shell.
Well, they're cyborgs. A little different.
Mm-hmm. Cyborgs is part human, part robot.
Exactly. So it's like living. I think the Terminator definition is the best. It's usually like living components tied to you know, inorganic robotic components. But I really would say that when you get the skin off of one of those T-800 units or whatever, it really is an android at that point.
You see, I don't consider the Terminator a cyborg. A cyborg, I think of $6 Million Man, which is a robot-assisted human.
Ghost in the Shell is clearly a cyborg, and $6 Million Man is clearly a cyborg.
Some of the characters in Ghost in the Shell are cyborgs.
What I'm saying, the main character, the sergeant or whatever. Now, when it comes to Cyborg and Terminator, I would say that, you know, he self-identifies as a cyborg. He said he's a cybernetic life form, living tissue over a metallic endoskeleton. Mm. So I think you're right. I think it can go both ways.
Lines
I'm not
going
to be exclusive on a cyborg. I just want to make sure we're all cool with the robot versus angel. And then there's one more word. And this is a word that, you know, it's been used politically recently. And that's the word drone, right?
Drone is something completely... Drone isn't necessarily a robot.
It could be a wasp or a bee or an ant. Those are drones. But when we're talking in the technology space, a drone, much like a robot, is a device that takes action on behalf of humans. In the case of a drone, that doesn't really have the artificial intelligence or thought directly associated with it. So we think of like the drones that use that do surveillance, or the drones that like blow up things.
Right.
Those are usually run by humans, and they're kind of like a
pilotless vehicle is what I think of when I think of a drone.
Okay, so that's the definition that comes out of
or
modern usage. Just kind of like it's kind of like how the news always says things get decimated when they get destroyed, and the two are almost exactly the opposite.
Sure.
So the word drone it's considered a robot in general. There's combat drones and unmanned aerial vehicles. They're target drones. You know, when Luke is sitting up in hanging out in the Millennium Falcon with the blast shield over his face and the little thing is shooting at him, that's a drone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a type of robot. So androids, drones, types of robots, and that's where we are. But to Google and Andy Rubin,
who's
now the head of Android. He was the head of Android.
So they bought seven companies, these seven technology companies that are going to be part of this consortium that's going to start developing robotic technology for Google. There's like a company that is made up of former Tokyo University roboticists. There's a company that does just computer vision for robots, robots that can load and unload trucks. There's a company that makes robotic manipulators intended to work side by side with humans. One that just does robot arms. A company called Bot and Dolly that just does robots to be used in cinema. And
when you say cinema, like you mean those awesome shots you see where it's moving smoothly around the entire
like motion controlled.
The motion controlled thing. Yeah, like a crane almost, but it's thing. But it's a robot doing the work based on a calculation that some person put inside there.
So these are companies, like there's no specific plan as to what Google is intending to do with these seven companies, but the investment is fairly large,
significant,
yeah. And when Google jumps into something like this with at such a broad scale as this, purchasing seven different companies, you know it's going to be something that they're intending for broad adoption.
Yeah. So you know what actually happened? They figured out that driverless cars were not going to work, and so now they need robot butlers to steer them.
I think it's a bit of both. I think they're looking at driverless cars, and that's kind of that was a little tiny pilot project, really focused project to see if their artificial intelligence was bright enough to do complex actions in the real world, to take the place of a human in an everyday task like driving. I mean, that's everything I've read. The driverless car is a piece of what's going on here.
Sure.
And that's already gotten legislation behind it in some of the Western states like Nevada.
Oh, yeah.
Nevada's like, based on what we've seen,
we're opening the road for driverless cars. Now, the CEO, president of Nissan, the leader of Nissan, the car company, sat in front of Congress the other day and said that he believes driverless cars are 10 years out from 2013. So by 2023, driverless cars that may or may not have crazy large satellite situations on top of them the way the Google ones do, are things that Nissan can say, says that they can push out. And this is the guy who, 7 or 8 years ago, sat in front of Congress and he said, by 2012, we'll have a fully functioning electric vehicle that is affordable for Americans to drive around. And Nissan has the best-selling, most affordable electric vehicle on the market, the Nissan Leaf. That car's won every award possible for a standard, you know, four-wheel, non-supercar kind of thing. So driverless cars are coming, and the driverless car in and of itself is kind of a robot. But what's Google going to do with what Andy Rubin's doing? What do we think is going to show up? What have you guys read?
Well, some of the speculation online is that that they would be using creating robots to be used in manufacturing, like electronics assembly, or you know, automating portions of an existing supply chain on a factory floor.
Which makes a lot of sense if you think about it. How much money is Apple spending on Foxconn, Foxconn talent in order to put together all these iPhones, iPads, and other devices? If you can automate much of that, you're going to get that economy of scale that only Tim Cook has been able to pull off for the last 10, 15 years. And if you can mash up and mix up some of these companies that we've seen here, you'll see some great stuff. I mean, right now, a lot of cars are produced with robots made in Germany.
Yep. I'd love to see them like spin this off into helping to get the driverless vehicles and other robotic consumer technologies out the door.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Google does this kind of thing because they're focused on consumers. This is one of their quote-unquote moonshot projects, which is tied to another example of a moonshot class project would be the driving car, which is independent from this, but will clearly be integrated if it takes off. And then there's also the Google Glass, which is a moonshot project that's, again, something that's what they consider a multi-year project. It's not something that they can roll out within a few months of whatever, right? Despite the videos and stuff we saw earlier in 2013. So yeah, I feel like this is kind of tight. I want to say that I'm excited about the fact that this is one of those things that I could really, you know, in the next, and I'm going to go long shot, in the next 10, 15 years, we could see, you know, really fantastic housekeeping situations being taken care of. Friends for your pets. Right now, there is a Roomba, an iRobot Roomba-like lawnmower on the market for like $1,500 to $4,300. You can get a device that will cut your lawn, figure out how tall the grass is, and figure out like when it's going to have to come out again to cut your lawn. It's got like acres and acres of battery. And that's it. You know, that's you know, nothing. You could have to think clean your pool nowadays. And if Google's behind this and they want to put all their resources behind this, they can make it real good. And they, you know, they've got operating system chops when it comes to the intelligence inside of Android and Chrome and so on and so forth. I mean, there, something could happen here. But it's all vaporware until we see something.
Right. Okay, let's move on here. So we just had Black Friday and Cyber Monday. I don't know. Did you guys take advantage of any of the deals? I know, Dwayne, you hinted that you didn't do any Cyber Monday or Black Friday shopping.
Well, it's weird because in England, they don't have Thanksgiving, so they start the Christmas season.
Oh right.
Early. Like, we got there November 20th. Everything was lit up. Christmas music was playing. And it's all American Christmas music, which is weird because you're in England. And you're in Scotland, right? So they're not talking like the guy singing. They're talking like Scottish people. But it's all Christmassy. And yet, the funny thing is, they have advertisements for Black Friday. They don't have Thanksgiving, but Black Friday is very real. And it's very present.
Even in Canada, like, it is as well, too. Like, Canada has their own Boxing Day, but they also partake somewhat in our Black Friday too.
No, I mean, they've got Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas, but they've also got their own Thanksgiving, Canada. They have a Thanksgiving. It's not the same date as our Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's a couple weeks early.
Yeah, it's a little early, but then their Black Friday is the same as our Black Friday. So, yeah, it's just weird because I feel like with Canada, you get to have Black Friday because you had Thanksgiving. Everyone gave thanks for what they have. Now there's deep discounts on gear to buy. You can be even more thankful. But England's just like, no, we're just going to have Black Friday.
Didn't Black Friday come originally from England?
I know it came from the fact that people go in the black. Businesses go in the black from being in the red.
Black Friday was actually coined. That term was coined by the rich. By the cab drivers of, I believe, Philadelphia, if I'm not mistaken, who, you know, the traffic was terrible on that day, the first shopping day after Thanksgiving. And so they called it Black Friday. I have to look that up. It's on Wikipedia, but I believe that's where the term came from.
Everything I know about it is that your business goes in the black on Black Friday. But the funny part about all that is, speaking in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, William Penn died in the Tower of London. So those guys have no reason to celebrate Black Friday, but they do. And it's all over the place. It's kind of crazy that that it happens that way. And they're crazy about Cyber Monday, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, who doesn't love discounts? And apparently everyone did because sales surged into the record-breaking sales. It was 21%. Web sales rose 21% from 2012. As far as Cyber Monday went, sales were up 17%. And they attribute a lot of that to mobile shopping, which is a sort of a new aspect this year than it was last year or in previous years.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what I saw on Black Friday, I did actually attempt to get one of the Amazon Black Friday bundles for some sort of like baby playset for a friend, actually. It appeared twice, but it was immediately gobbled up very quickly, and I ended up having to go with the same thing, but at a higher price later on. Mm-hmm. I did really consider picking up a few game titles, as well as picking up the James Bond box set, which I quickly mentioned, because It was a really nice price, $100 for Blu-rays of all films that are currently out.
But how do you get a James Bond box set, knowing that there's going to be another James Bond movie?
So the way you can justify this one is the 50th anniversary box set.
25th movie, 50th anniversary. I get that. I'm just saying the minute they have a 51st, and I have this problem with Doctor Who, right? Like, I'm a Doctor Who fan. Yeah. It's been around 50 years. There are 800 episodes of the thing. How do I get a box set? And I really feel like what they need to do is have a quote-unquote collection. So they sell their DVD, and then they give you... There's another DVD, like a version, right? Like, in terms of Doctor Who would be like the All of Time and Space collection. And you get that version of the Blu-ray or whatever, and you'd add that to your thing. So they all have the same branding, the same look, the same feel, regardless of when they came out. Because the whole box set thing, I feel like, is a scam if they're not done yet. Like, you want to give me Buffy, the what's it called collection? You know, that's great. The Chosen collection, that's great, because Buffy's over.
You just you should be able to just purchase a streaming license outright.
Well, I mean, maybe it's an incremental streaming license. Yeah. Absolutely. I think in today's day and age, I want to be able to get access to all the Doctor Who episodes from all time and space. And I'm using that term as if it's a branded term. It's not.
Yeah, I was like space time?
No. In Doctor Who, the TARDIS is about all of time and space. It exists in all of time and space. It's frequently used. But... I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, there should be some sort of incremental, you know, like Audible, right? Like, I'm paying, right. I pay, you know, right. I guess in this case a little differently. I'll pay one upfront price, and then in the next, every time a new one comes out, I'll just pay like $7 or $8 or some other number more.
Sure.
And I'll get access to that one too, or whatever. Or in the case of a physical media, if people really want that, then, you know, they send out a similarly branded
like the other ones were branded, version of the DVD case and everything, and I added it to my collection. That helps everybody. You have a collection, and the collection gets to grow, and you have to be current, so you rush out to get it. It's a limited edition of them, so they know that they're going to sell all out. At the same time, the value of those things goes up, and they can re-release whenever they want. They can pull the Disney thing with the re-releasing and the this and the that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It's just an easy way for them to make more money.
I guess.
And everybody wants a collection. Tosin is a complete case in point, because I'm not going to lie. Who doesn't love James Bond? I'd love to watch all 25 movies in a row. I mean, that's kind of a life goal for me, right? Yeah. Just sit down or stand up. I like to stand up when I watch TV. And, you know, sitting will kill you.
Over time, yes.
And just watch, like, you know, a movie. I have, like, a marathon. Like, get a whole bunch of buddies over and, like, you know, get some vodka martinis and
shake
drink.
Them and don't stir them.
Shake yeah, them.
I feel like that you what you proposed is actually a very brilliant idea, but I also feel like a lot of places don't like to think that far ahead.
Well, if you're as storied as James Bond or Doctor Who, if you've been around for 50 years, you can afford to think ahead. I'm not asking you to think ahead if you're something like, I don't know, if you're something like Lost. Right, mm-hmm. If it's something like anything that's come out in the last 10 years or whatever, I'm asking you to think ahead. Now that you've got a fan base that is loyal and diehard and has all sorts of stuff around it, culture built upon it, you could now say we have a collection for you, the fan, because we know you're going to pay more for this. And this collection is ongoing. It's forever. It's the Forever Collection. James Bond Forever. There you go. The Forever Collection.
I like that idea.
That is a pretty good idea. But I will say this current box set at least looks gorgeous. It is pretty gorgeous. Now, if only they didn't always have Bond on TV during Thanksgiving and Christmas. That was like kind of one of the things I was like,
it's not as actually good. Remember, it's not as good. You have the good stuff. When you watch it on TV, it's cut up at the worst moments. The formatting is all whacked. It's not, you know, it's letterboxed or it's cut off at the sides. You did the right thing.
Well, there you go. Okay, moving on here. This is probably one of the biggest stories of the week. Washington Post, Barton Gellman and Ashkan Soltani report that the National Security Agency is gathering nearly 5 billion records a day on the whereabouts of cell phones around the world, according to top secret documents provided by Edward Snowden. The NSA doesn't target Americans' location data by design, but they acquire a substantial amount of information on the whereabouts of domestic cell phones, quote, incidentally, which is a legal term that connotates a foreseeable but not deliberate results. The capability to track location are staggering based on the Snowden documents and indicate that the agency is able to render most efforts at communication security effectively futile. They've got the way they've got their system set up. They have red flags for certain operations. Like, for example, if people use disposable cell phones, switching them on only long enough to make brief calls, it marks a user for special scrutiny. The system takes note also when a new telephone connects to a cell tower soon after another nearby device is used for the last time. Also, side-by-side security efforts. For example, if everyone in a conference room powers off their devices or turns them on together at the same time.
A flag goes up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I would do it if I were them.
Right.
This is like the essence of true intelligence. When it comes to software, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these things, a lot of these connections happen after the fact. So the fact that this cell phone, someone turned off and then another cell phone went on, you know, it takes a couple days to realize that cell phone, when it went off, it was the last time that cell phone was used for some time. Right. Yeah. That takes a bit of like, you know, looking back at data and making use of that data. So, you know, it's all the kind of stuff that, frankly, if I was buying intelligence, if I was an intelligence purchaser, yeah, and this was a product, yeah, yeah, that was for sale, the service was for sale, this is how I'd want it to work, right? That's pretty morbid to say that, right? But it's right. This is how I'd want them to be looking at patterns, finding out what they can from patterns, and, you know, doing what they can to send appropriate people to those areas.
Oh, it's brilliant in its efficiency, only that the fact that it's used is that it could potentially be used to spy on Americans and may in fact be used to spy on Americans. Who knows?
So you're saying if only they could use their powers for good instead of evil.
Yes.
But that's exactly what they say they're doing.
That is what they say they're doing.
I guess my worry is that they might take this power, this ultimate, you know, this great power and not use it responsibly.
So you're saying with great power comes... Never mind.
It's interesting. There's a couple of interesting points.
Glad that you took that setup and went with it right there. I feel like what's worse? This situation or the whole, like, tracking your porn usage so that they could discredit you later?
They're both pretty bad.
Second, the tracking your porn usage, that's like J. Edgar Hoover kind of crap.
Yes, totally. We talked about that on the last episode for sure. Yeah,
I think this is more logical and less spiteful than that, right? That's all I'm going to say. This is less spiteful than that. Being like, oh, all these people in this area on these disposable phones, turn them on at the same time.
Yeah.
We should look into that. Is way less spiteful than being like, oh, we think that guy's a terrorist. Is he using porn?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is some interesting points from this article. NSA Director Keith Alexander disclosed in Senate testimony in this October that the NSA had run a pilot project for this in 2010, 2011 to collect samples of U.S. cell phone location data. And then he said that he allowed a broader collection of such data that may be something that is a future requirement for the country, he said.
Oh, that's the scary shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You think that was related to the whole Apple getting found out that they had all that location data?
I doubt it. I mean, the
timeline matches up.
Speculation. The NSA said when asked for numbers about the number of Americans the program had spied on, they said it would be awkward for us to try and provide any specific numbers, meaning that there are definitely specific numbers of Americans this program has spied on.
Awkwardness is a crisis in confidence.
apparently, unnamed corporate partners administer the NSA's physical systems.
Oh, like Edward Snowden was? Corporate partner?
Well, like who knows, like Google or AWS or, you know, Amazon. Apple.
The iPhone. I mean, think about it. The iPhone's so pervasive, and it's a one company shot to hit all of that data. Mm-hmm. Dude, this is totally, it's speculation, totally linked to the Apple location gate scandal from 2011, 2012. Look, speculation.
It's disturbing. It's just as disturbing as any of the other NSA announcements.
I bet the NSA was like, Apple, you should create a way for us to find people's phones.
We keep losing them in bars.
Apple, you should do something along the lines. This mobile me thing, it's too expensive. Make it free.
And make it only accessible to us. Yourself. So moving on, the enrollment records for a significant portion of Americans who have chosen health plans through the online federal insurance marketplace, the errors in filling those enrollment records out have affected roughly one third of the people who have signed up for health plans since October 1st. According to government and healthcare industry officials, the mistakes include failure to notify insurers about new customers, duplicate enrollments, or cancellation notices for the same person, incorrect information about family members, and mistakes involving federal subsidies. The errors, if not corrected, means that tens of thousands of customers are at risk of not having coverage when the insurance goes into effect on January 1st. Julie Batale, a spokeswoman for Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services, said that about 80% of the errors stemmed from one bug that prevented a Social Security number from being included. That bug has now been fixed, and it's part of the, and that part is now working properly.
All that was tied to one bug.
Y2K.
Or if that were, like another software company, like it's a feature.
I think like the bottom line is that this is a clear indication that the government really knows nothing about IT.
They don't. So they hire people who are supposed to, but those people really they know about getting government contracts and not so much about right. how to run more than IT. Really, it's services. It's web application web services. The government is not. It's not their focus, and some people say, nor should it be, but in the case of this, it also shows that we're in a strange place. I mean, maybe a single-payer healthcare situation like what they have in Europe is far more simple to pull off than this sort of super piecemeal, you get what you want, kind of like sort of pseudo-shopping experience.
Yeah, I mean, it also shows how tightly coupled – you know, our experiences are with technology. I mean, this is where we're at, where a mistake like that can cause tremendous damage, not just, you know, for the large business organizations out there, but for just everyday people who are just trying to, you know, get a normal checkup or do some sort of routine health, health examination. And so there has to be a lot of care in the system, and it's something that you should never take lightly.
We're so tied to this. You have to think to yourself, you know, like everybody in this country has a phone, not a cell phone, but a phone line, right? Everyone in this country also has access to electricity. This goes to show that the internet is now one of those root level utilities, you know. Just like you have a water bill and a gas bill and an electricity bill and a telephone bill, the internet is now one of those root level non-luxury things. And you need to think about that as a culture, because it's just so necessary that people be able to use this for this government mandated healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the internet and, you know, I people out there trying to do this for the developing world, like Mark Zuckerberg and so on and so forth. But here in America, you know, if you've got a local power company, like your city, your municipalities has like a power monopoly, I don't know that it'd be too bad to do the kind of stuff that Longmont and that, Philadelphia and a couple other cities have done, where they become the internet provider, the owner operator of the internet services
right.
in their area, instead of the Comcast, Time Warner situation. That I think every single person who's ever guested on this podcast or been on this podcast has complained about.
Yep. Monopoly of services, of internet
right.
services.
I mean, a benevolent monopoly exists when it comes to like your power situation. When it comes to your water, when it comes to a lot of times the gas in your house or whatever. I feel like the internet is just become. It just shows you that, you know, the government is relying on the internet, so the government should be behind the internet.
Under Armour this week announced the purchase of fitness app company MapMyFitness for $150 million. Now, Dwayne, you sent me this link, and this is significant because, you know, we've talked about the quantified self on this show quite often, and about how more and more companies are starting to integrate the concept of the quantified self into their products. And this is like a signal that Under Armour, that one of the largest fitness apparel companies in out there right now is putting their full confidence into the idea of quantified self. And MapMyFitness already has this huge online community.
I mean, this is a great marriage. This is one of those marriages where I think about, you know, we talk about stuff all the time here. And I think this is a really interesting phenomenon. Now, if you've been listening to the podcast, when we're talking about media, you hear us saying, Netflix says that they have to become HBO before HBO becomes them.
Yeah.
This is a case of Under Armour saying,
we have to do the same thing. We have to, we are focused. And the reason why Under Armour has grown so quickly over the last several years, because they're a pretty young company, they've grown quickly because they focused on the physical technology. They focused on materials that get you, that are lighter, that get you drier faster when you're sweating, that compress your muscles to get more out of your performance. And they're saying, we've got to catch up with Nike before Nike, who, while they have great technology, is very brand-based, but has this this digital stuff on the side with Nike, the Nike Plus system. We've got to catch up to Nike before Nike takes over what we're doing on the apparel side. So I mean, if you're Nike, Under Armour has been a thorn in your side for a while. They came out with clothes that are a little, you know, their high end stuff is probably as expensive as yours, but you know, people can get really good stuff from them that's really cheap, and it really focuses on this idea of the physical technology. And now what they're doing with MetMyFitness is saying, hey, your iPhone, your Android device, your mobile device will now be intrinsically connected. We're integrating what you buy in the apparel store with what you get out here. I think that's a big deal, especially when it comes to some of the newer products like cleats and so on. There's going to be some stuff that allows you to really quantify who you are. And I'm a big quantified self guy. I mean, my cats have Fitbits on their collars. Like I'm, right. I'm all about knowing trends about me or them or whatever, because the minute those trends begin to deviate, you have to look at what the issue is. And if you can optimize yourself, if you can compete with yourself and among a wider community, I mean, that'd be great. The only real loser here is the guys that started this all, Garmin.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they started all this quantified self stuff without even knowing it. They didn't know what they had, and they dropped development on it like 3 or 4 years ago, and that's just that. But yeah, I think that what they're doing is exciting. I had hoped that Under Armour and Fitbit would make some sort of connection, but you know, with the M7 processor and an iPhone 5S, and the ability to take that information and use it with your Under Armour clothing, that's awesome. Under Armour has the capacity to make wonderful, you know, super ergonomic armbands.
Right.
I've seen a couple. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, Nike has done a little bit of it, but mainly in, like, their athletic shoes for, say, soccer. So they have, like, step trackers, all sorts of things in their shoes, which are pretty amazing. But now you have, like, the ability to have it throughout a full product line. Now that's really amazing. As well as now you have the community around that to really – because one of the things that makes Fitbit so successful is more so the community and the ability to, you know – pursue common goals with other people. I mean, it may not be the best configuration out there, but it works and it drives people to better themselves and others.
Fitbit is I think you and I agree. Fitbit is a standout company. I love that company, and I'm unabashed about saying that. I think that what they're doing is really fantastic, because I have an emotional response to the way they create and market products that I use. That said, from a more objective perspective, I look at what Under Armour and MyFitness does, and I know Lululemon just came out with a pair of running tights that has a side pocket for an iPhone that fits an iPhone 5S almost exactly, an iPhone 5, 5S configuration almost exactly. When the iPhone 5 and 5S first came out, well, the 5 came out, I complained that the device was really light and the battery wasn't as good as it could be, because I couldn't understand why you'd need such a light phone if you could shove more battery in there and make it heavier, then make it heavier. But now that I'm doing physical stuff with my phone, like running or whatever, I realize that the lightness really does matter. Once you have the M7 chip in there, you know, I was, you know, out of town for a while. I didn't bring my Fitbit charger because the thing usually lasts for a week or so, but I was gone for longer. And the Fitbit one that I use actually died. So I was like, oh, well, this won't be able to throw into my Fitbit stats, but let me track my like movement anyway. I keep my phone in my front right pocket on my jeans. I found a couple apps. I went on the internet and said, which apps use my M7? I found a couple apps. I loaded them up, and they had my movement data for the last week in them the moment I opened them for the first time, because the phone's been tracking it anyway. Wow. If you're Under Armour and you can harness that and maybe some embedded pieces, maybe some Bluetooth Low Energy, and tie that to your clothes, I mean, that's where I get really excited about technology as a guy who loves snowboarding and all the tech that's associated with that, this is huge. And we're seeing this all over the place. These companies can't just be apparel anymore if they want performance. Performance means trackability, traceability. Performance means showing that you're getting what you're paying for out of these clothes. So when you're in that Under Armour, you're able to push yourself that much farther when you're doing that race or whatever it is you're doing. And I think they have to show that. And that's what this Map My Fitness is going to be able to do for them. So I'm excited. I'm excited for them to show, to have like Why Things integration and all that stuff.
Speaking of interesting acquisitions, Apple recently acquired social media analytics firm Topsy Labs for more than $200 million. Topsy specializes in analyzing the global conversation on Twitter. Their tools can decipher how often a term is tweeted, find an influential person on a specific subject, or measure the exposure of an event or campaign. It's interesting for Apple to buy Topsy because, I mean, what this says to me is that Apple is looking to include more Twitter data, to integrate more Twitter data into their own services.
Well, I mean, this makes sense in some ways. They could be looking to integrate Twitter data, or they could be looking to integrate social data overall. Applying Topsy's work to other social networks is important. Also, though, think about it this way. Topsy is a data aggregator that shows how these social networks are working.
Yeah.
Apple has, for half a decade, screwed the pooch on creating their own social network. By understanding better how these networks operate, they now have a chance either at, you know, getting more out of these networks for themselves or creating one themselves. Now, the problem with an Apple network is the fact that Apple software often needs Apple hardware in order to work properly. While iMessage is a pretty great phenomenon, people love using it, there isn't a lot in the wider social sphere that wants to be linked to just Apple's devices. So it's interesting to see how they're going to, if they want to do a social thing, they're going to be quite open, which will be an interesting thing to try and see. Now, if they want to just figure out how to take better advantage of the social that their devices are being used for, which is really, you know, pretty big, right?
Twitter is deeply integrated. Facebook is deeply integrated. Who knows what's next? If they want to figure that out, then, you know, this seems to be the kind of company that would allow them to pull that off.
Yep. See, this is the kind of thing that they should have done a long time ago, is not try to invent the wheel from scratch themselves, but, you know, take advantage, leverage all of these pre-existing companies by acquiring them or other means, hiring their employees and building the stuff, building onto the existing knowledge that the these companies have.
Well, at least hire them.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't want to take apart the whole thing, at least hire them as a consultant to help you figure out what's going on here, there, and everywhere. I feel like Apple has to lick this beast. Social is the key. It's the key to the content kingdom, right? Yep. Look at BuzzFeed right now. BuzzFeed started off as a series of lists about, you know, random stupid stuff that makes you laugh. They've got reporters all over the world covering the Arab Spring and like what's going on in Ukraine and everything now. And they become like this super crazy media channel because they have the ability to create the content and have it spread like wildfire across the internet. Apple needs to think about the content perspective. And now they've got the radio store. Now they're going to cannibalize their iTunes sales for the radio stuff. They've got to figure out how to better share that content and create new content.
I think it's interesting that this is one of those aspects of Apple's businesses that they've completely, you know, I can't put it better than you have, screwed the pooch on. It's something they've completely neglected or have just mismanaged.
Yeah. I mean, it was never their strong suit. It was never their place. You know, getting your finger on the pulse of office software a la iWork, not too hard.
easy to improve. Operating system, pretty difficult, but easy to improve. But when you begin to look at social, they just tried and tried and tried. And the fact is, when you can't beat them, you join them. Some of the best features of Lion and Mountain Lion, and that, you know, that kind of changed the game when it came to operating systems, was that you could just swipe over to the side, and your notifications were there. Twitter was right there. Facebook was right there. So they realized that people use their computers for this stuff, and those widgets allow them to track it, and these guys will allow them to hopefully come up with insights based on that traceability.
Okay, we're going to take a little break here and talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about this week, appropriately enough, is iRobot by Isaac Asimov. Now, anyone who's read this book or who hasn't read this book, you should be forewarned that this is nothing to do with the Will Smith movie from of the same name.
Well, it has something to do with this. Is that Will Smith's the Will Smith movie from 2004?
Yeah,
it is largely inspired by iRobot, but iRobot itself is an anthology of tales about humans and robots in the far-flung future for the guy who invented the term robotics.
That's right. That's right. The laws of robotics, the three laws of robotics, which were our key to this work, were one of the major sort of carryovers into the Will Smith Asimov-inspired movie. But beyond that, yeah, it's basically just a sort of like an anthology, as I couldn't have put it better than you did right now, an anthology of tales of robots in the future and how they interact with humans. It's a classic.
What are those three laws?
The three laws. The three laws, Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics are as follows. Thank you for asking, by the way. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
It's written like code, guys. It's so logical. What's number three?
A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection doesn't conflict with the first or second law.
Now, if everyone worked in that way, there'd be no murder, there'd be no anything. Everybody'd just be so helpful, except for the whole must obey somebody. That'd be slavery. But other than that, I mean, it's great. So the book shows you these laws, which seem to be relatively tight, right? Like, you can't really get a screw-up if these things happen. And yet screw-ups happen all the time because of those things we never knew. And it's a great way of kind of, like, thinking about the problems of robotics. And basically, of how you make a thing, a piece of technology, digital technology or whatever, how you make that thing become like us. Like, how do you make that inanimate thing human enough to do what you need to do, but not human enough to be completely independent? That's like the challenge that they keep on coming across.
How do you make machinery respect human life?
And its own life.
And its own life.
It's a great like kind of mind twister. The best thing about this book for a lot of people who are like, man, so you know, the whole book about robots and laws. It's an anthology, so it's a whole bunch of short stories. You can pick it up, read that short story chapter, 12 pages, whatever, put it down, feeling like you got through something. So it's a great, and that goes double for Audible, right? You know, you only have a little bit of time in your car for the commute. You listen to it, you get to work, maybe you sit in your car for another minute or whatever, or on your way home. Between getting to work and going home, you've heard a whole tale. That's great.
Yeah. It's great. It's tiny little chunks. It's perfect. It's perfect bite size reading for the Audible format. So in any case, that book, or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours. For all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to check out their service. If you don't like their service, you still get to keep iRobot. It's a classic. You should just get it. It's a classic.
This is one of those things where just like Tosin in the box set, I'd love like an Audible box set of my favorite series.
You know, actually Audible does have a category that is like masterworks, where it's basically the classics of literature.
Wow, they've got everything.
But
the little picture that you get, the little like art,
uh-huh.
Is it like the masterwork collection? Because that's really what I want. All I really want is a little piece of art of my digital stuff telling me that it's part of a wider collection.
So that I can collect them all, like Pokemon.
But then you feel inadequate when you don't have all of them.
That's right? The point.
All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, not all drones are deadly. Some just want to deliver your packages. Take a listen to this and come on back.
Oh my god, it's a bird! It's a plane! No, it's a drone! It's my package. Wow.
It's your packages here. It's Amazon Prime. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuaken. So, Amazon is experimenting with drones that will deliver packages within 30 minutes. Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, made an announcement in a 60 Minutes interview Sunday night with Charlie Rose. Bezos expects the drones to be fully autonomous and in operation within 4 or 5 years. There are number of tests and regulations that they have to deal with in the meantime. For example, the FCC, there's a regulation on the board that says that it's illegal for commercial operations to run drones. They're trying to get that lifted by 2015, so nothing can happen.
FCC, the FAA.
I'm sorry, the FAA. You're right. Yeah, I was confused.
I wonder about the FCC too. Now that you mention it, I don't know if you guys have looked at your technology in the last, I don't know, forever. There's always that little warning that says this complies with FCC rules about, you know, messing up planes.
Yeah, yeah.
And all that stuff,
yeah.
Which is why you can use your small electronics on a plane now.
Sure.
Finally. So like they have a lot of regulatory stuff to get through before this can get done.
Yep.
But I mean, this idea of Prime Air, I don't know. It's to me, it's both impressive and ridiculous. It's more than both. It's impressive and ridiculous and a little scary. When I say scary, I don't mean people putting pipe bombs in my Prime Air drone. I mean, you know, I live in beautiful Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
We're all about big sky.
Yeah.
Looking up and seeing the wide expanse of, you know, the 5,000-foot elevated world. And the idea that I'd see, you know, 6 or 7 little buzzing things around, because everyone in Boulder uses Amazon Prime. And I know that if Prime Air, even if it costs like $100 extra a year, everyone would use Prime Air.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of like seeing all these like Jetson drone things like cluttering up the sky would really kill me.
Would you be disappointed by the air traffic, the increase of air traffic in the beautiful Denver skies?
Yeah, well, Denver skies sucks. Boulder skies are wonderful.
Boulder skies. Sorry.
I would say that the thing about it is that it reminds me of Star Trek 8 or AKA Star Trek First Contact, where they're like, oh, there's the moon. And, like, the future guy is, like, Riker's like, I mean, the past guy, Cochran's like, yeah, of course it's the moon. And America's like, well, in my time, it's got, like, you know, advertising on it or whatever.
Oh,
you're like,
that would
be awful. Or, like,
that would be
he said Tycho City, I think. Tycho City was on the moon. And they let you look up to the moon and you see, like, spires and blinking lights of a city. You know? Call me a conservative. Well,
you know, so for me, I actually, for the longest time, I wanted to actually get one of the Parrot drones so I could actually fly it over to so I could fly it over to this Chipwich place in downtown Palo Alto to see if there's a long line called Cream. There's always a long line, but there's a short line. I'd fly it over, see if there's a line so I could either get over there or even have it deliver me Chipwiches.
Flown a Parrot AR drone?
Yes, and it's
awesome.
Dude,
they do not fly easily. That is a lot of work, especially when you're not next to it. When it's out of sight and you're trying to manipulate it,
I have not.
Any number of things can happen to your.
I have not done that. So I could lose my Chipwiches. That is.
You could lose your Chipwiches, or you could use your $300 styrofoam toy. That's what that thing is.
I think it's a pretty cool thing that they are. Well, I mean, it's always great when places are innovating. Like we kind of discussed before the podcast. There are a lot of other places which actually do this right now, and mainly in like China or other international waters. There's a pretty good podcast on drones, both the military as well as the public ones on a podcast called Tech Stuff a few episodes ago. But I think, Dwayne, you had a really good point about this, that although like all these other places do it, you know, there's the sort of popularity that Amazon can bring to such things. Do you want to discuss that at all?
Yeah, just like, we talk about all this stuff. Like, the MP3 player was out, and then, like, Apple came with the iPod. You know, Germans built the first car, and they had all these wonderful coaches. They were building these beautiful vehicles, and Ford popularized them. That's why Ford is known for the car. Apple's known for the iPod. Amazon has the scale and, you know, the fulfillment superpowers to make this a regular thing in our lives. And while old fuddy-duddies like me might be concerned about seeing a whole bunch of little prime air dots all over the sky, Amazon's got the wherewithal to do it and probably do it fairly tastefully. I mean, look at FaceTime. FaceTime is an interesting product. People are getting to use it, whatever. But honestly, when you think of a face-to-face communication on your computer or whatever, I feel like Skype is really one of the more powerful tools out there that's being used. Why? Because they started with the whole VoIP thing, and because it's not too hard to get that done. Already, Amazon has gotten the new Kindle HDX devices, and they've added this Mayday support to it, which gives you, well, from the commercials, it gives you a gorgeous redhead to talk to if you have a problem. But, you know, the idea that you're going to use face-to-face communication from your device for meaningful, useful work-like tasks is something that Amazon is popularizing right now. I think Amazon, if anybody has the ability to do this, they are that nexus of online and offline that I think a lot of the tech industry is trying to tackle. I mean, their mission statement is to get the best products in the world, to find and deliver the best products in the world to the consumers, or something along those lines, to paraphrase. And it's fantastic that they even have like the dream to dare to dream that they could kind of deliver on this level. And it also just kind of goes to show that Google is not the only one out there doing moonshot thinking. It's a relatively, the weird thing about this is, you know, the self-driving car seems like a crazy, ridiculously hard thing to pull off, but Google pulled it off. Google Glass, they're still working on it. This robot thing, who knows? But with Amazon, you can see this really focused situation. We have a drone. We know that it's going to have 20 minutes of battery life for each way. So in a major metropolitan area,
it can carry up to 5 pounds, which Amazon says is like 85% of the packages they ship out anyway.
Right.
They're developing. They appear to be developing their own proprietary copters. They're not quadcopters. They're octocopters.
I mean, they would have to develop their own situation in order to pull that off. And then you've got the fact that, you know, they've already tapped the United States Postal Service
Yep.
No one uses the Postal Service effectively. Maybe Netflix. Netflix does. But, you know, like they're tapping the Postal Service to deliver their stuff on Sundays. I mean, that's a major government integration right there, right? So they're working with that agency independently, and the post office is run independently from, you know, Congress and so on and so forth. In order to pull that off, it stands to reason that the FAA and the FCC and whoever else might be in the way of this, and not because they're in the way because they want to be in the way, just because, like, this is a technology no one ever thought of before. The fact that they can, you know, make inroads into those organizations and get things done is not beyond Amazon. So, you know, it's definitely one of those things like, wow, I never even thought that was like a possibility. I think is the wow factor that I'm feeling right now.
Did you guys check out the 60 Minutes interview with Bezos?
No, I only saw the video and read mm-hmm. up about it. Now, it's one of those things also where 60 Minutes is a legitimate offline way to discuss this technology. I mean, 60 Minutes broke huge stories over the last 30 years or so.
Sure.
So the fact that Bezos is like, I'm the tech guy who just bought the Washington Post. I also run the biggest retailer in the world, which happens to be the back end of like 90% of mobile apps. I'm exaggerating. So yeah, let me talk to you about how we want to deliver products. 60 Minutes, like the New York Times of news, of TV news.
Well, some people like Dan Lyons, who is the former senior editor of Forbes and was the fake Steve Jobs, said that, that he feels that that reveal of the Amazon Prime Air was calculated specifically to boost Amazon's image, because apparently Amazon is and Jeff Bezos himself are reeling from a publication of a book by Business Week reporter Brad Stone, The Everything Store, which was a portrayed Bezos as a ruthless tyrant and a penny pinching ball buster.
I mean, I've read that, and the fact is, if a man like Jeff Bezos can be described anywhere near like the way Steve Jobs was described,
yeah,
are we that surprised? So I get it that, you know, Amazon wants to drop something literally.
They're shifting the narrative.
Right. Shift the narrative. Yeah. You know, I get it. That's great. Was it necessary? Probably not. I mean, who's reading this book? It's going to be a whole bunch of tech people.
But I mean, the question is,
they're going to talk in tech circles, whatever. I think it's great that they want to do that. But the fact is, this isn't completely vaporware.
Right.
You know, and if it is, 16 minutes is going to have hell to pay in
the
future.
Sure, sure.
But I mean, you don't pull that situation off. You know, it's a concept. They said it was a concept. I don't know.
There were some really interesting things about this interview. You should check it out, because I found like the conversation that Charlie Rose had with Jeff Bezos was really fascinating. Some things I didn't realize, like, for example, I didn't know they demonstrated how they store things in their warehouse. They don't store them by category. They store them to optimize to utilize the available space in the warehouses as determined by a computer. So they can have two completely disparate products sitting next to each other on a shelf, and it's solely based on the product size. You can have a book next to a box of crackers.
Baby stroller.
Yeah, yeah. And it's based on the size and the available space in the warehouse, and not by...
See, in my mind, that's how I would do it.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's perfect. That's how it should be. But yeah, from a library perspective, you can see that'd be a problem.
And Jeff Bezos, he said in the interview that he was asked how he would describe Amazon. He said he likes to think of it as customer centric. Also, we'd like to explore. We like to go down dark alleys and see what's on the other side. I think that's something that we haven't seen that since, the Google guys do that, and Apple does that. I feel like that's a characteristic of some of the best.
When does Apple go down dark alleys to see what's on the other side?
You have innovations like the iPad and the iPhone, and these are not these were not necessarily invented by Apple, but they did take the risk to popularize them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see what you're saying.
And plus some of the design aesthetic as well can be considered like bold and risk taking.
Right. I mean, you look at Kindle, when the first Kindle came out, people were like, who would possibly ever get that? And now it's Kindle, you know, it's a de facto, it's a standard. Amazon Prime, the normal Prime.
Yeah.
2 days, yeah. Everything.
Yep.
$80. Who would do that? And you're like, yep. Oh, they would do that. So yeah, I completely see it with the Amazon, the idea that like, we're going to do this. It's going to happen, you know, make it happen.
Bezos said something really interesting in this article that I found was incredibly sort of insightful for him and the company in general. He says that in the long run, he was asked like, how does he take care of shareholders if their margins are so thin, you know, it's hard to make a profit. It's hard to give good value to shareholders when their profit margins are so thin. He said, in the long run, if you take care of customers, that is taking care of shareholders. He says they've done price elasticity studies, and every time the math tells them to raise prices, but they don't do it because doing so would erode trust, and that erosion of trust would cost them more in the long term. That long-term approach, he says, is rare enough that it means you're not competing against very many companies. Most companies want to see a return in investment in one or two, 3 years, and he's willing for it to be 5, 6, 7 years. Just that change in timeline can be a very big competitive advantage.
Yeah, he goes for long-term growth over short-term gain.
Yeah.
And I mean, Amazon's been around for a very long time. They survived both the boom and the bust to be a robust, ridiculous company, ridiculously successful company. So
yeah, it makes sense, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's always about the long-term picture and where your growth is going to be as an organization. So I think he does make pointed moves, and that's why so many people come back to Amazon, because trust it. They like, if you really think about it, as the typical price-conscious nation that we are, or individuals that we are, quite a lot of people nowadays just go directly to Amazon to quickly order an item because they know it'll be shipped in time and they know that they'll be getting reasonably good value. There's a lot less
Your information is already in there. You've never heard of Amazon doing anything with your data. I mean, they used to sell email addresses, but that was like more than 10 years ago. They're trustworthy because all they are is about getting you what you want for as cheap as possible. And you can get behind somebody who's got that mission for you. It's like they've got you in their back. And then a lot of that trust comes from the fact that they produce content. And when I say content, I don't mean TV shows. I mean, they solicit users, in some cases, but even without having to expressly solicit users, users jump on that site and they tell you all about these products. It is one of the best places to go to learn about something, whether you're going to buy it from them or not. You know, you can go and click these ratings, and you know, many of the better devices have hundreds upon hundreds, if not thousands, of ratings from people. And that's the kind of thing that builds a crazy amount of trust.
Yep.
They've got their Vine program, which allows super reviewers to gain access to products and like do an in-depth deep thing, sometimes on video, sometimes just the writing. But yeah, Amazon builds trust because they have this content, and they're basically saying, yeah, you can buy it from us, and sometimes it's going to be a dollar more, a dollar less, but look at what we've done to show you the worth and power of this product, you know. And they've even put that over in Zappos, where now Zappos, I think every shoe has a video review now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Very difficult to do logistically, but fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's great to have.
Not to be outdone in vaporware announcements, The Verge has learned that the world's largest parcel service, UPS, has also been experimenting with their own version of flying parcel carriers. Sources familiar with the company's plans say that they've been testing and evaluating different approaches to drone delivery. As for a comment, UPS said the commercial use of drones is an interesting technology and will continue to evaluate it. They're always planning for the future, they said. So everyone's doing it, you know. All it took is Amazon to come out and announce it. And I think drones are here to stay. Drone delivery is here to stay. It's just a matter of time until the FAA, you know, we can get the FAA to bend the rules on their on what goes up in the air. I know for a fact, like, there's a map online that shows you where public use of drones is legal and where it's illegal. And at least in California, it's not illegal yet. So you can fly drones fairly freely without any sort of risk of breaking the law here in California.
There you go, Tosin. You're all clear to go to use your
I'm all cleared for takeoff or to make my droid fly.
It's gonna go on my wish list for next year.
R2-D2 will deliver packages to anyone in the greater California Bay Area error code.
All right, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, Boston Dynamics humanoid robot gets a little more humanoid. Our drill down video of the week. Take a listen to this, and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. Boston Dynamics, the robot research facility funded by DARPA and famous for developing the Big Dog, Cheetah, and the humanoid Petman, has evolved Petman into Atlas, a 330-pound humanitarian robot designed to save lives in disaster zones like Fukushima, for example, where it would be, you know, deadly for humans to traverse into for all the radiation. In December, seven teams of scientists from top institutions, including MIT and Virginia Tech, will compete to code the bot's brain for action. Each team will send its own Atlas into DARPA's trials, which are eight tasks that will test their ability to navigate degraded terrain, drive a utility vehicle, and enter buildings. These are like the tasks of Hercules, except instead of Hercules, it's Atlas, their robot. Did you guys see this video that we've got linked to this? It's really fascinating. It's the Boston Dynamics Atlas, and he's walking over it's very interesting. It's very telling that I'm already giving it a sort of a human pronoun. It is walking over rough terrain. This was formerly the robot that was doing the push-ups and other sort of running exercises in place, but now it's sort of untethered. It still has sort of a tether to keep it from falling over if it should lose control, but it's untethered and it's walking over rough terrain.
The head they had in one of the previous shots reminded me, I was like, Aquaman or something. It's pretty crazy. For one, Boston Dynamics is a pretty amazing place with all the things that they've developed over the past years. It's always cool to see what they're going to do next. But I don't know. This is just like, it's really uncanny. It really is uncanny.
Yeah.
But it's quite powerful, and it will be, let's see what happens in, you know, a couple years.
Yeah. These guys are going to build the robots that these guys are going to build the Terminators, essentially.
Yeah. The robots that will take over the world.
Yes. All right, I think that does it for this episode of The Drill Down, with the exception of going around the table here. And I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
Always on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. You can also check me out on gplus.to/DwayneD. And you can find me here on The Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. I like the bread. You can also find me at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. And I may actually start another blog soon of the progress of my R2-D2.
That would be awesome.
I would your R2 unit?
That. Yes.
R2-4321?
Yeah, I really should do it that way.
As for myself, I'm at Facebook and Twitter at Mr. Baby Man. That's my social media handle. Just do a Google search for Mr. Baby Man. You can find my work there. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. You can also leave a comment on our iTunes page. Give us a review. If you have a viewpoint on any of these stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.